be away, and even I think better to be back. I've given lots of hugs this morning. Just excited to see people and to be back and get to connect again. And if I didn't get a chance to hug you yet this morning, I'd probably grab you on the way out. It's just great to be back. We had a delightful time. We first went to Western Nebraska to see my mom. A number of you have met my mom over the years. She's been here. Not able to travel at this stage of life, but she's been here in the past and asked about many of you. She remembers your names and faces and what's going on with various families, and it was good to catch her up. And I appreciate you praying for her over the last few years, especially as she has had a number of health challenges, in and out of the hospital with bladder infections, kidney infections, pneumonia. But doing well, in fact, doing maybe as good as in the last 10 years health-wise. Last year, she sold her home, and while we were there on vacation, if I filled you in at that point, we did a large garage sale and helped get everything ready for the sale of her home. And now she's in an apartment that's in a great neighborhood, a great area. She has good neighbors around her who she can take care of, and she gets taken care of as well. A nice little place, and we were able to get out and enjoy because she felt good. It was just a delight. And my mom, many of you met her, she is just a social butterfly. This is true. When we are there, I often have to tell her, "Mom, can you please just turn your phone off?" Because she's taking calls from, this person's calling, that person. She's just in this network of people. Small town, 25,000 people or so. She's lived there nearly all of her life. She owned a business, and not just a business. She was a cosmetologist. And ladies, that just answered all of your questions right there, didn't it? She knows everybody in town. The joke is, if we go out with Mom, how many people are we going to see that she knows? Not if we are, but it's how many and how long it's going to take to have her visit with those people and hear about everything going on, and so we can move on about our business and what we're doing. Vacation takes longer when we go see my mom because every stop is extended, and she gets these calls. It's fun, though, this vacation to hear her talk about these relationships, because the last couple of years with these health challenges, she hasn't been able to get out as much. But she was filling us in on her Saturday night group of ladies that go out to dinner. Some of these ladies aren't believers. In fact, many of them are not. And she gets an opportunity to share Christ with them and continue to connect with them and pray for them. I try to talk with my mom a couple of times a week throughout the year on the phone. And sometimes it's every day of the week. I'll try to give her a quick call and check in. And I get to hear about this person she's talking with or this person and catch up, as well as her church relationships. Last Sunday, we went to church with her, and we were the last people to leave. It was like I was at work. We were the last people to leave. Seriously. It was her, our family, and the pastor of the church and his wife, who we're friends with, so it was nice to catch up a bit. But just her social life. And I appreciate about my mom, and maybe it is this hairdresser, business owner, small town matrix that continues on in her life, but she is concerned about people. And she's concerned about helping people, praying for them, trying to minister to them. She is about her family, certainly from a distance, but proximally, she's concerned about the people around her. And I think she has a healthy view of wanting God to work through her in these relationships. I want to think with you about that this morning from Luke chapter 16. As you're turning there, again, if you're a guest with us, we have been walking through Luke. We began at the beginning of 2017, actually, and now here midway through 2018, we're moving through Luke's gospel and following Jesus. Here in this section that begins in chapter 9, toward the end of chapter 9, is this long section that goes for about 10 chapters of Jesus' final trip to Jerusalem. And along the way, Luke's gospel includes situations, teachings, that aren't in Matthew, Mark, or John. It seems to be an extended portrait of Jesus' final trip to Jerusalem, including chapter 15. None of chapter 15 of Luke is found in Matthew, Mark, or John. So Luke's giving us this extended portrait, if you will, of Jesus' life and his teachings, his emphases of God and of the kingdom of God. And the last month, we've enjoyed hearing from a couple of our interns, Jacob and Travis, preaching and following on through Luke. And there in Luke 15, last week, Travis helped us to understand God's disposition as a prodigal seeking God, that when the prodigal son comes to his senses and comes home, the father is looking out and runs to the son. And this is God's grace. This is the richness of God's pursuit and his passion for his people to rescue, to redeem. I had a chance to listen to Travis's sermon yesterday with family on the way back to Kansas City. It was just a delight to hear of God's power. But if you can recall last Sunday, or if you listened between last Sunday and now, Travis helped us to think about this not just from Luke, but the idea from Ephesians chapter 2. Do you remember that? He walked through Ephesians 2 and sort of knit these ideas together about God's grace and about human sin that needs grace to be saved, and God is the Redeemer, the Rescuer, and he walked us through Ephesians 2. And the famous verses, Ephesians 2, 8, 9, for by grace you've been saved through faith, not of yourselves. It is a gift of God, not by works, and we think of Jewish works law, lest any man should boast. It's this free gift. And Ephesians 2, 10, following 8 and 9, is a verse that allows us to springboard here into Luke 16. For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, to do good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we should walk in them. That's Ephesians 2, 10. God saved us, not by works of the law, but by his own mercy and grace. He saves us. He saves us to do good works that he's prepared. And that's what I want to think with you about today, and seeking to connect the dots between Luke 15, this presentation of God's unique work, and what Jesus would have the disciples to do, to participate with God, this prodigal, powerful God. Along the way of Luke 9 through 19, Jesus has continually emphasized this idea of the disciples being insiders and those who can extend themselves, can go the extra mile, can count the cost and trust God to meet their needs in giving themselves away, being hospitable to those who are outside. And here in this teaching, at the beginning of Luke 16, that same idea is taken up, and it's, on the surface, turned around. Jesus tells a parable where the main character becomes the one receiving hospitality. And he seems to be the figure that he wants the disciples to give attention to. It's almost going from being hospitable to receiving this hospitality. And along the way here in these first couple of paragraphs of Luke 16 that we'll look at, there are two key verses that I just want to set out for you to be on the watch for. Verse 4 and verse 9. The idea of welcoming comes in verse 4 and again in verse 9. Initially, it's a physical welcome, later a spiritual kind of welcome. And the drama of this teaching progresses from verse 4 to verse 9. And how this takes place, how is it that this figure, this manager in the parable, goes from being taken in physically by people to them welcoming him spiritually? What is that like? And what is our hospitality lesson from that? So, in a question, how might we partner with the prodigal God? In Luke 16, 1 through 13, Jesus told his disciples this parable to help them understand that stewardship of resources hinges on relationships. And relating with people in such a way that we have influence over them to the degree that they would one day welcome us into the kingdom. We are here at Luke chapter 16, and when we set out at this parable, we need to recognize that it is one of the more difficult. Craig Blomberg teaches New Testament at Denver Seminary, has for several years written several important books, and here's a daunting statement as we begin today, writing about Luke 16. The story of the unjust steward is perhaps the most perplexing of all of Jesus' parables. Welcome back from vacation. Right? The most perplexing. Why is that? What is going on here? Well, as we go, we'll try to unpack the flow of thought and again return back to the broader scope of these chapters. Chapter 14 and the emphasis on hospitality. Chapter 15 and the prodigal God. Chapter 16 here, beginning with this parable and then going on to teaching about the rich man and Lazarus. And we see that underneath the surface of many of these teachings is money, hospitality, and those begin to rise to the surface here and provide us connections and grounding for interpretation. Joel Green writes, quote, "The parabolic instruction Jesus now provides here in Luke 16, 1 through 13, is closely tied to the preceding, especially chapters 14 and 15, all having to do with the intricately related issues of hospitality. What it means to be a host, what it means to receive hospitality, and how those connections can be made." Join with me then in the text, noting especially chapter 16, verse 4, and again, verse 9, and this idea of welcoming. We've read much of this already. Let's begin in verse 1 again, and note the audience specifically. Jesus now says to his disciples, this is on the heels of teaching to the Pharisees, chapter 15 and verse 1, and the scribes who were complaining about Jesus, and this along the way with great crowds traveling with Jesus, and at times he turns to this specific audience, the disciples sometimes directing toward the Pharisees, sometimes toward the whole crowds. This is to the disciples. After teaching about the prodigal God, and the Pharisees especially being in view, the disciples likely hearing this, he now turns his attention directly to the disciples. And this is what he says. There was a rich man who received an accusation that his manager was squandering his possessions. We'll stop there. When we get to the parables, we immediately want to fill in the details, to equate the figures. If there's a parable and there's a figure in view, we often want a corresponding interpretation. This figure represents this. And we've done that in chapter 15, right? The father represents God. Two sons. There are a number of ideas that come up, but in many ways we want to think Gentiles and Jews corporately. We want to think about the prodigal son maybe being representing the Gentiles and the Jews, this other son, and Jesus getting at the Pharisees because they have had God's teaching. They have had the great richness of Jewish heritage, Abraham's descendants and so forth. And here are these Gentiles who went away. And the Jews are upset that Jesus is so freely interacting with Gentile populations, tax collectors, sinners and so forth, like the prodigal son. And so we want to do the equation, if you will, and have an interpretation right away. Here in this parable, and again with Craig Blomberg's comment a moment ago, it may be good to step back and hesitate from filling in a cell that would equate one figure to someone we might know to God in this way, or to hesitate for a minute about that. We could fill it in as we go, but just for a moment. There's a rich man, verse 1, and he received an accusation that his manager was squandering his possessions. So we have a rich man. Let's just let this rich man be a neuter figure, if you will, for a moment. And we have this manager who's squandering his possessions. In the ancient world, managers were such important people. They were highly skilled because they could deal with both people and property, but a third element as well, processes that people did with property in order to provide profit. So you have these managers, and they manage people and processes, material to provide a profit, all of this going on. These individuals were often recruited by the Roman military to fight because they had great capacity physically and mentally. They were good administrators. And if you were a rich person, you wanted to hire successful managers because those managers could run your property, your slaves, and they could earn you increase. But this guy wasn't. At least that's the accusation. He was a squanderer, verse 1. So this rich man, verse 2, calls in the manager and asks a piercing question. "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you can no longer be my manager." This is a personal meeting. At times, just as in our day, if there's a large operation and if someone needs to be corrected, someone might send a delegation to go give a message of encouragement or rebuke. But this is personal. The rich man, the owner, calls the manager. It's personal. Give an account. And it seems that the rich man provides a bit of delay. There's a bit of hesitation. I'm going to give you time to give an account. So go get the books and show me what you've done. Verse 3, the manager says to himself, we have self-talk here, "What should I do? My master is taking the management away from me." Jesus is providing us insight into the manager's thought processes. We're now in his head. And he lists the options that he could look to. Management being taken away, option A, digging. But what does he say? He's not physically fit to do it. Option B, begging. He's too ashamed, too much pride, can't do it. Option 3. It's option 3 that is the hinge point of the parable, and it's what makes the parable hard to interpret. Because Jesus ultimately here seems to set this action up as commendable when on the surface it seems unjust, deceptive. Notice the text. "I know what I'll do," verse 4, "so that when I'm removed from management, people will welcome me into their homes." This is the issue right here at the end of verse 4. I said it earlier, verse 4 and then again in verse 9. It's this issue of welcoming. This man thinks in his head, if I can arrange some situation so that these people will welcome me, then I'll be successful, I'll be taken care of, even though I don't have my management position. So, verses 5 through 8 fill in the details of how we go from the hope of being welcomed to being welcomed. Verse 5, he summons each of his master's debtors. "How much do you owe my master?" he asks the first one. And it's likely that the language is intense. It's likely this is full of feeling. 100 measures of oil," he said. "Take your invoice, sit down quickly." Notice the urgency. Verse. "Sit down quickly, write 50. Cut your debt in half." Verse 7, he asked another, "How much do you owe?" It's almost as if he's going from house to house or one relationship quickly to another. "How much do you owe?" 100 measures of wheat," he said. take your invoice, write down 80. In the parable, we have oil and wheat brought up, common commodities of the day. One commentator, Donald Hagner, notes that these are not small quantities in this day. This is a large operation. This is a manager's over a large quantity of material. He notes as well that when Artaxerxes allows Ezra to go back to Jerusalem after the captivity in Ezra chapter 7, these items are amongst the items that Artaxerxes says Ezra should have. And in fact, these two amounts, this amount of oil, this amount of wheat, this is a large operation. And this man is cutting the debt. So how would you feel if you were the debtor? Just imagine your own debts. Perhaps you are in debt to the bank on your home, a vehicle, maybe a student loan. How would you feel if you received an official notice from the creditor and they said, cut it in half? And here's my name. Remember my name. Cut it in half, and remember, you're not dealing just with an institution, you're dealing with me personally. Right? That's what's happening here. It's personal. This is not just about the cutting of debts. It's about building a relationship. It's about a strategic plan to build a relationship for future gain. That's the point. The point of verse 6 and cutting the debt, the point of verse 7 and cutting the debt is not about debt, it's about relationships. It's about an astute, shrewd plan to connect with someone in such a way that you would have future influence, be welcomed in. You'd have receptivity from them. Verse 8, the master praised the unrighteous manager. And this is what's problematic for us about the parable, because we see that this manager isn't being faithful. We would not want to hire someone like this, right? I mean, if you're an owner, you're losing money here. But what's turned around is that this master praises the unrighteous manager. And allow Jesus to interpret his own parable. Verse 8, because he had acted astutely, in light of a present crisis, he had arranged a scheme so that he could be welcomed later, so that he could have influence later. He acted astutely in light of the times. And notice what Jesus says. Verse 8, for the sons of this age, and if we'll allow verse 8 to set up an antithesis of one group and another, the sons of this age, that is the sons of darkness, are more astute than the sons of light in dealing with their own people. The sons of darkness are shrewd, are astute, are thinking about advantaging themselves in this relationship, and this is what they do. It's almost as if Jesus is comparing and setting out what we might on the surface think of as a sinful practice, and he's saying, that kind of mentality I want you to have, but inverse, in such a way that you are astute and shrewd about building relationships, because the exchange that's going on is more than a business exchange. Notice the flow of the text, verse 8 to verse 9. The sons of this age are more astute than the sons of light in dealing with their own people. And I tell you, make friends. That's the point of the parable. It's not about business so much as relationships and friendships. Make friends for yourselves. That's the point. and the parable provides the means, by means of the unrighteous money, so that when it fails, they may welcome you into eternal dwellings. It's here where the inverse of hospitality takes place. Throughout Luke's gospel, he has presented that Jesus is, especially in chapter 4, verses 18 and 19, when Jesus in Nazareth, and he stands up and grabs the scroll of Isaiah, and he reads Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2, the kingdom of God has come near. This is the year of the Lord's favor. He's proclaiming good news to the poor, setting captives free, recovery of sight to the blind. This is the year of the Lord's favor. And you disciples, you go be hosts. You spread this message. Do you get the point of the parable? Be so shrewd, so astute in your generosity with money that you will be welcomed by them ultimately. Be so astute in using financial resources to gain influence in relationships that you could have a spiritual influence, because if you do this, those financial resources could be so robust that they would be converted and they would welcome you into eternal dwellings, not just temporary ones. Notice verse 9 again. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of the unrighteous money, so that when it fails, when it runs out, you have used it in such a way that it has gained you influence, and they will welcome you where? Notice the end of verse 9. Not just to their homes, like this unrighteous manager hoped, but where? Eternal dwelling. Kent Hughes gets right to the point. Just who are these friends who will receive us into heaven? Who are these eternal friends? Those who have heard the gospel because of one's giving. They are the ones greeting and leading a faithful believer into eternal tents. Our wealth and possessions are to be used to win eternal friends. This is the proper use of what we have. We must give generously of our money for the furtherance of the gospel. If we're not doing so, we're not making proper use of what God has given us, and we're not enhancing eternal relationships. This is an intensely spiritual matter. Yeah, the point of the parable, though it is difficult and it's tough sometimes to find exact correspondence, and it presses us at first to think that someone who's unrighteous would be praised. But allow the comparison just for what it is. Read no more into it than what Jesus says. But don't diminish what he says. If we're going to partner with the prodigal God, and he is about relationships, that's what we must be about, with our money. This is a vision-casting parable. This is Jesus setting out for his disciples. That's what verse 1 says. He's teaching his disciples about what we should do with our possessions and our lives, gaining influence that they would welcome us into eternal dwellings. The picture is potent. So potent is this potential with relationships that we have greased, if you will, with financial resources for the true purpose of the gospel and welcoming us into eternal dwellings. That's faithfulness. That's stewardship. Kent Hughes continues, it's not enough to give money. We must devote our personal belongings to making eternal friends as well. The mere giving of money can be so sanitized and insulating, But when we use our homes for others so that our personal space is loaned, when we use our vacation homes to refresh others or let others borrow our cars, then we have begun to touch upon what Christ says. One day, our most precious things will fit into a hospital drawer. The only wealth that will endure is that which has been invested in others for the sake of Christ and His gospel. That's good stewardship. Notice verse 10. Whoever is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. Whoever is unrighteous in very little is also unrighteous in much. What is the very little here? The very little is whatever financial resources would be in view. The very much is the spiritual matters, the eternal dwellings. Jesus continues this sort of gnomic teaching in verse 10, verse 11. If you've not been faithful with the unrighteous money, who will entrust you with what is genuine? Verse 12, if you have not been faithful with what belongs to someone else, who's going to give you what is your own? This is just Jesus questions that logically flow from the point of the parable. If you're not with this, then you won't be with that. If you are with this, you will be with that. So here's the point. And this is going to continue through chapter 16, just as it surfaced here and there since chapter 12 and following about money. Jesus will say later in chapter 16, it's impossible to love God and money. The way to think about these two together is using our money for God. And how do we do that? Via relationships. We use the wealth that we have, whatever amount it is, to love people, to gain influence for the gospel in their lives. And the parable presents this process of partnering with the prodigal God as so powerful, so potent, that they would welcome us into eternal dwellings. It's your converts welcoming you to heaven. That's the point. Sometimes we think our money, our giving, our financial resources can't be all that influential. This parable argues the opposite. Darrell Bock writes, either possessions or God will gain the loyalty when a choice is required. People should give priority to God and be generous with resources. And that generosity is in relationships. It's in using what we have for relationships, for the influence of the gospel. Notice how Jesus concludes the matter. Verse 13. No household slave can be the slave of two masters. He'll hate one, love the other, be devoted to one, despise the other. Jesus' point here is about God and money. A point that the Pharisees are going to find problematic here in the last half of chapter 16, just as they have earlier. So if money is not your God, what's it used for? If we're not worshiping money, what's the point of it? To help other people worship our God. To gain influence via relationships with a view to such potency that they welcome us into heaven. The resources that we give, that we use personally to build relationships with lost people, influence eternity. That's stewardship. That's good stewardship. Good stewardship demands a relational grid. It is not just about property. It's about relationships. The last time I preached, the end of April, I noted Rosaria Butterfield's new book, The Gospel Comes with a House Key. It was published the end of April, and since I've got a copy and I'm on vacation, got almost through it, she writes this: "The imputation of Adam's sin rages on, pitting man against man, man against God, and man against his own conscience. Hospitality is the obvious bridge that brings desperate people into a Christian home where they can both receive and give great blessings. Do Christian people practice Christian hospitality in regular, ordinary, consistent ways, or do we think our homes are too precious for criminals or outcasts? Our homes are not our castles. Indeed, they're not even ours." How can we partner with the prodigal God? Jesus' parable, and it's a bit perplexing at times, seems to tell a story of the effectiveness of generosity in relationships from Christians to outsiders, that gives influence, spiritual influence, and a potent influence, so much so that our converts could welcome us into heaven. What more authentication do we need of their conversion? Let me just tease out three ideas here as we conclude. Three ideas for practicing this work with the prodigal God, for partnering well. The first is this, and it starts with our heads. Understand the times. Understand the times. So much of Luke is about what has happened in the past being fulfilled in Jesus. Here, Jesus says something about the future and brings it backward. Here's a future reality, and in light of this future reality, I want you to act a certain way now. Jesus and the New Testament, not just Jesus, but it often reaches into what is eternal and what will take place and sets that out with lessons for now. This is the way things really are, really will be forever. So in light of that, do this today. In light of the potential of converts from MCC and from your life welcoming you, we should live a certain way now. That should guide our financial decisions. So it's understanding the times. Second, relationships matter. Good stewardship, apart from relationships, and in Jesus' view, relationships with the lost, isn't really good stewardship. It's not just having a well-manicured whatever, yard, house, things looking nice, working well. Those are all important. But we take away gospel influence and potential gospel influence from those things. What use are they? None. Relationships matter. Third, final theological idea. If we are seriously going to live in this kind of way, where we think of the resources we have not for the sake of earned interest, but for the sake of the interest of other people and eternity, not for greater quantity for ourselves, but to give away, if we're going to have that grid, we are going to have a robust view of God's ability to meet our needs. That God is a provider. We're going to have a theological understanding of God's ability to provide for us. Jesus states this several times in Luke chapter 12, especially. I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you'll eat, your body, what you'll wear. Life's more than food, the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. God feeds them. Aren't you more valuable than birds? So much of what I've said today comes down to this very issue. Do I trust God to meet my needs? If I do, it's not a problem for me to think of my resources being used for spiritual benefit, because I know God's got my back. I can give it because I know God will take care of me.